Good morning again, everybody. I love thinking about love and all of its different facets and how it can be very present, it can feel very far away, and how that I think this is all, when it comes down to it, our practice is a practice of love, loving ourselves, loving each other, learning to love what even feels unlovable. It's a big practice. So I want to talk about that today. And I was the inspiration of it because it came because I was thinking about Valentine's Day on Monday. And, you know, a lot of ways that you might relate to Valentine's Day or not, might be part of your world, might not be part of your world. And I'm not a big one for externally imposed Hallmark holidays. That's not really what I'm drawn to, but I do think about it. You know, it's in the culture and it's pretty hard to miss it. So anyway, it is a day, and we can expand that to a week or a month or however long we want to widen it out to express love, to let it in, to receive it. As I'm thinking about this talk today and our time together, is to take the path of love. How do we take the path of love? You know, the Buddha has many, many lists of teaching lists. And the very first thing on several of these lists is the practice of dana, the practice of generosity. And oftentimes we can think about generosity as giving something away, but it is also a practice of receiving. It's a reciprocal relationship that is so important in the practice of generosity. So this is just another thing to drop into our conversation today, is how generosity is a facet of love. How do you relate to the practice of generosity and reciprocity? Is it easier to give than it is to receive? That's often the case for many, that it's an easier thing to give, that we can have a habit of dismissing that we are worthy of receiving. So on Monday, which Valentine's Day was actually the 37th anniversary of when my husband and I got engaged. And that didn't happen on purpose, actually. We did not plan to get engaged on Valentine's Day. And the reason it happened was because we both had the afternoon off and we had talked about getting married. And so the formal engagement in our culture of here's a ring, but it was, we had both had the afternoon off to go to the jewelry store together. And that was the entire reason why it happened on February 14th, 37 years ago, 1985. And so, you know, it's a sweet day for us. It's got that infused into the day. And this year, actually, he wasn't even home. He was visiting his mother across the country. But, you know, after 37 years, we get it. And it doesn't really matter where we are physically. But the other thing I was thinking about is like the more subtle forms of showing up and how do we connect with each other. And where I live is a pretty rural place, 300 miles north of San Francisco. I'm on the coast in the Redwoods, and I live in a neighborhood that it's a rural neighborhood with country roads, and there aren't any sidewalks. There's barely a shoulder on the side of the road. And when I go out for my daily walk, I greet the pigs and I greet the cows, and that's a windy, hilly road. And this is where I live. And I have a habit that I started many, many years ago on this walk that I do almost every day of waving to everybody. And I, whether I know them or not, people that go by in their trucks or their cars or other walkers, and I wave. And my initial reason for doing it is because there aren't sidewalks and there is not much of a shoulder. I want to be seen. I want people to slow down in their driving and say, oh, there's a person who's walking. And it works. It actually really works. If somebody waves a little bit, the driver takes notice. But it's turned into a whole practice of, you know, sometimes people really wave back enthusiastically. Some people kind of look and say, who's that? I don't know her. And sometimes, I don't know if you know this one, people's hand on the steering wheel, you get the one finger wave. Somebody, you know, the one, just the one finger. That's good enough. You know, my point is, I'm here. Please slow down. But it's nice to see you today. And I used to walk with my dog all the time, and she's not here anymore. So she was really obvious. It was pretty hard to miss her. She was a big German Shepherd. But now I walk myself or with a friend or with my husband, and I still get that curious look of, who's that? Why would I wave to her? But slowly the culture of the neighborhood is changing, and everybody's waving to everybody. And it's very, very sweet. So it's just a practice that's become my habit. So here's a poem that reminds me of exactly that. This is called Neighbors from James Cruz. Where I'm from, people still wave to each other as if someone doesn't, you might say, of her, she wouldn't wave to save her life. But you try anyway, give her a smile. This is just one of the many ways we take care of one another to say, I see you, I feel you, I know you are real. I wave to Rick, who picks up the litter while walking his black labs, Olive and Basil, hauling donut boxes, cigarette packs, and countless beer cans out of the brush beside the road. And I say hello to Christy, who leaves almond croissants in our mailbox and mason jars of fresh pressed apple cider on our side porch. I stop to check in on my mother-in-law, more like a second mother, who buys us toothpaste when it's on sale and calls if an unfamiliar car is parked in our house. We're going to have to return to this way of life, this giving without expectation, this loving without conditions. We need to stand eye to eye again and keep asking, no matter how busy, how are you? How's your wife? How's your knee? Making this talk, we insist on calling small, though kindness is what keeps us alive. Isn't that beautiful? You know, don't doubt that your place in your neighborhood, however small or large, whatever your place is, it matters. Probably somebody picks up the litter, but the idea that somebody leaves almond croissants in your mailbox, I mean, what an amazing thing to do. I do have another neighbor, now that I get on this neighbor thing. Again, this is a really rural area, and at the top of our road, we live at the bottom of a hill on a dirt road, and at the top of the hill, there are our neighbors have, some of them have horses, some have pigs. It's a little bit of an ag area, and different politics, of course, and one of our neighbors has a sign that says, we don't call 911, with an image of a gun. And so, you know, I can see some of your faces going, oh my God. And yeah, oh my God. But you know what? He's really a good guy. And he really cares about us and his home and the neighborhood. And so we don't talk about that sign. We don't have to talk about that sign. We have to get underneath it. And I actually know he would call 911. You know, I do know that. So, you know, we can have all these projections on who we are in a neighborhood and what is it, what are the faces of ourselves that we put forward? Does it come out of fear? Does it come out of love? Are we willing to wave to just anybody we don't know? Because truly, I was doing it out of safety for myself. That's where it came from. And it still comes from there, that I am walking in a place that doesn't have sidewalks or a shoulder. And I do want people to see me, and I do want people to slow down, but it happens through saying hello. You know, it just happens through that presence of showing up. So how do we take this path of love and take the path of generosity? Let's start with the refuges, these refuges that we take in our practice all the time, to take refuge in the Buddha and in the Dharma and in the Sangha. I think it's all a practice of love. We commit to this practice of of kindness, of ethical conduct, of seeing clearly, of doing this together. And so I think it is taking refuge in generosity, giving oneself to the full path, making a commitment towards studying the Dharma, the truth of how things are, towards showing up together time after time after time we show up. And that's part of this path of generosity. You show up and you come with your hearts, you come with your minds, this dedication towards understanding and clarity. I think it all comes down to a practice of love, which inherently is a practice of generosity. So can we take refuge in love? Now, I have a tendency with the refuges to take liberties with them and add whatever refuge I want. I offer that to you because if you take that word refuge, that quality of feeling safe and at ease and held in a reliable place, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha certainly include the full breadth, I think, of our experience, but we can get more specific with it, to take refuge in noble silence. If you have a time that you take time for retreat, or even in your own day, maybe it's 5 minutes where you choose to turn towards silence and it becomes a refuge. I know I have that feeling of just quiet for 5 minutes. That's a refuge where I can reset myself. I take refuge in the earth. You know, all the ways this earth is the ground of everything. The trust, the reliability, the way we need to nurture this earth, the way it nurtures us. There's a refuge in that. And to take refuge in love. So you can get more specific with it, if that's helpful for you. If thinking about taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha doesn't quite name it close enough for you, name it closer so you really can feel the beauty of connecting and committing to something that holds you so unconditionally. There's another triplet list from the Buddha. And this is another way of thinking about the maybe three legs of a stool that hold our practice. And this is the practice of dana, sila, and bhavana. Dana, again, is generosity. Sila is our commitment to ethical practices, the study of non-harming, being serious about that. Not only not harming externally, but not harming internally. And bhavana, that means to cultivate, to study. This is the training of our awareness, of our minds. So we learn to train towards more balance, more love, more awareness, more steadiness. And again, I think that love is what holds it. The dana, the generosity, the sila, the bhavana, that is held in this greater expanse that I think of as love. The Dalai Lama says, through kindness, through affection, through honesty, through truth and justice toward all others, we ensure our own benefit. This is not a matter for complicated theorizing. It's a matter of common sense. Isn't that true? And this is what I love about the Dalai Lama. He's very commonsensical, very logical. That's what I love about our practice. Through kindness, through affection, through honesty, through truth and justice toward all others, we ensure our own benefit. This is not a matter for complicated theorizing. It's a matter of common sense. And so we come back to, you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. And this is what the Dalai Lama is saying. This is logical. We do it for ourselves. We do it for each other. We do it for each other, others. And at the same time, we're doing it for ourselves. So that's where I want to start today. Is this path of love includes the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the generosity, all stimulated from Valentine's Day or inspired from thinking about what's on my mind this week. So let's move into our longer meditation now. We'll sit for about 30 minutes and I'll offer some guidance in the beginning and then I'll give you a little guidance here and there, but we'll really take this time to settle into the quiet of our own hearts and minds in whatever way they are today. So please find a posture that suits you, in which you have some comfort, where you can rest, but also to stay present. Just begin by noticing if there's any holding anywhere, maybe in the jaw or in the face anywhere. Maybe opening and closing the mouth to loosen the jaw. And as the face relaxes, coming down the throat and into the shoulders. If you like, gentle shrug of the shoulders up to the ears and just let them fall softly down. Little relaxation coming down the arms and the torso, down into the base of the body. Holding just enough energy in the back of the body to stay attentive, present. Softening everything else. The muscles of the chest and the belly, so there's a little room to breathe. And trusting the base of the body and the legs to support you just as you are. In this steady, dignified posture, adjust when you need to adjust to be able to stay attentive. And in the space to breathe, maybe you notice your breath somewhere specifically, letting your awareness rest there. Or maybe you just know you're breathing, and that's enough. So settling the awareness in the place that makes most sense to you, whether it's sensation in the body, the experience of breathing in, out. Maybe there's another place that works for you to settle your awareness. Maybe it's sound. Wherever that is, go there. And try to rest there. Try to stay there. Come back when the mind floats away, knowing how natural that is, and begin again. Every time you begin again is an act of generosity, especially if you do it without critical commentary. It's just saying, okay, begin again. Here I am. And we'll sit quietly. noticing what's happening on the inside. Is there any constriction or discomfort? There might be, and if there is, letting it be there, but offering it some softening, softening with your care. As if you're saying, I see you. I know it's here. And bringing some kind, tender energy to any area that needs it. Letting it release to the extent that it can. Any amount is the right amount. And also noticing any areas that are soft, any areas in the body that are relaxed. Let that have a place in your awareness as well. That sense of refuge in the body, even the places that's okay, where you can rest. And keep going. noticing any amount of ease or peace that are arising. Let that be a refuge, resting right inside this calm stillness. Any amount that's there is just right. And from wherever you are, once again, coming back, scan through the body. Is there any holding that can be released through a little softening? Softening anything that can be to bring this loving energy into your whole being, letting it pervade the whole body, all the way out to its edges and maybe even beyond. Becoming intimately familiar with the sense of ease, stillness, softening. Any amount is right. As we continue to sit for a few more minutes together, maybe getting a sense of the vastness of our collective practice. How it might feel like we're alone in our own meditations, in our own space, but we truly are here together, cultivating this kindness, this compassion and love, this holding together. From Rumi, we are the night ocean filled with glints of light. We are the space between the fish and the moon while we sit here together. We are the night ocean filled with glints of light. We are the space between the fish and the moon while we sit here together. So widening out the awareness, sensing this collective practice together. what we're doing here, from Rosemary Wattola Traumer. This is why we are here, not merely to survive, but to fall in love with the white-breasted hawk and the rainbow fish, with the lonely sidewalk and the shadows of ourselves. Fall in love with the hands of the woman wearing yellow and the girl who loves chocolate and the boy who loves cars and the man who makes us want to be a better version of ourselves. We're here to fall into unmanageable love, to love beyond reason, beyond fact, beyond certainty. We are here to lose all our ideas about love and to know it as the next choice we make, the next word we say, the next invitation we offer ourselves. We are here to love the world and each other, the way whales love water, the way blue loves a peacock, the way night-blooming jasmine loves night. Thank you so much, everybody. All right, let's take 5 minutes and come back at 10 after the hour. Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. So I want to keep talking about this path of love, the path of generosity, the path of companionship. How do we show up for each other and in all the different ways that we do or we don't, the things that get in the way, the things that are hard. And since I've been offering these triplets today, the triplets of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the triplet of Dana, Sila, and Bhavana, I want to bring in another triplet that actually doesn't come from the Buddha, comes from Pema Chodron in one of her books. Then I have relied on this framework in many ways. I find it extremely helpful. And what she says is we just need three instructions for our life. The first is be fully present. The second, feel your heart. And the third, engage the next moment without an agenda. Not so easy. Be fully present, feel your heart, engage the next moment without an agenda. So let's talk about those a little bit and how this relates to love, to generosity, to showing up, to companioning, to consoling, to celebrating, all of it. You know, the first one of these, to be fully present, is the intention of our practice. And we start with this awareness of the body through our senses. One of the quickest ways to become present is to actually place the attention in the various senses. What are you seeing? Visual perception. When we get very literal with this, and if you're really attentive to each one of the senses, it brings you very much into the present moment. So what do you see? Just take a moment and maybe name a few colors that you see. Same thing with sound. What are you hearing? The sound of my voice, maybe the fan on the computer, the sound of the heater. Who knows? Whatever the sounds are in your environment, just not going out to listen for anything, but just widening the awareness of the sense of hearing. And you can do that. You can go through all of these senses. Is there a taste? Is there a smell? Or the sense of touch or temperature? And for me, with temperature, I want to know, how is it that my hands can be cold, but my core is warm? I mean, that you can get really specific with this. How does the sense of temperature work in your own awareness, in your own body, how it changes, how it moves? So any of these senses, to become fully present, we can see how some of them we like and some of them we don't like. We can see how none of it's solid. It changes constantly. My hands are cold now. They weren't half an hour ago. It's just like how this occurs. But if we're really present with the body, with what is physically happening in the body, a whole world can open up. And in fact, one of the early teachings in the Pali Canon, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness from the Buddha said, there is a body. There is a body. And that we can learn everything from being present with this body. And then we can start to see what gets in the way of presence. And oftentimes, I think that there's might be a way in which being aware of what is in the way has the most predominant voice. Let's just say it's a voice. So perhaps you're steady, very steady with listening, 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 hearing, hearing. And then something shifts and the mind gets taken away. What got in the way? Maybe some thought came in that is becomes the distraction. I says, I don't want to listen anymore. I don't want to notice that. All right, that's not so interesting to me anymore. So then we just start, there are a million things that get in the way of being present. And we could talk about that for a long time. The second one, feel your heart. All right, this is a training. This is such a big training. First off, can you sense your own physical heart? Let's just take that literally. Maybe you can, placing your hand on your chest or maybe your pulse, you know, and you get the sense of that there is a beating heart inside your body. But then how do we sense it energetically, or the emotions that we associate with feeling the heart? And this is where we can come into that beautiful teaching. You can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. What is the heart practice that is happening in there? It's a powerful influence, that sensing into the heart, or the experience of the heart being available and open, open-heartedness. When we show up and we can show up, and to Nancy's point earlier, knowing the joy and the sorrow that exists within the same situation, or so many things that others have brought in, to know this is the beauty, this is the sadness, this is the heart that shows up. Or when does the heart get armored and covered over? And that happens for all of us, where we might say, I just can't do this. It's too painful. And that can be a habit. So many of these things can be habits of places that get rigid in the heart. So can we even feel that? And I think when Pema gives us the instruction, feel the heart, she's not telling us how to feel it. She's not telling us what the heart should be feeling, just saying, see if you can feel it. And that's where we start. And so there are days where maybe the heart is too tender, where it's painful to feel it. Maybe there are days where the heart is really courageous in you, really present with everything that is going on, or a friend or someone you love is in a difficulty, and you have the capacity to show up. You have it. And so you do. And then there are days where you don't. This is feeling the heart. This is sensing into the truth of whatever our experience is. And part of the training around this, from the perspective of our mindfulness practice, is to train in these heart practices, in these practices that strengthen the capacity of the heart to be fully present. So these three things of be fully present, feel the heart, and engage the next moment without an agenda, they don't exist in isolation. They completely support one another. So talking about loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, gratitude, generosity, forgiveness, all of these are facets of the wise heart, of the engaged heart, and they need each other, right? They need each other. And sometimes the, you know, gratitude might not be present, but compassion is. Great, fine. Mudita, appreciative joy, may be distant, but metta, loving kindness, is here. And sometimes we get these times where the heart is so fully engaged and present, it's all here at the same time. And that's, you know, that's those moments of awakening where it all comes together and we have these deep understandings and we're not caught in the difficulties. We see more clearly. So one of the, let's just talk about these different aspects of, I think these are all aspects of generosity. Let's bring it back to how generosity works. This willingness, I think generosity is the willingness to be present, to bring ourselves to whatever's happening, and also to be receptive to whatever is happening. Does this make sense to you? Are you with me on this? Just like expanding how we think of generosity as a path of love. So with metta, loving kindness, the wish for ourselves and others to be well, to be happy. And, you know, we have the metta practice where we repeat phrases over and over again. May I feel safe. May I feel peaceful. May I be healthy. May I live with well-being. These are traditional phrases, and we use them as a meditation, a repetition of phrases. And it's said that through the practice of metta, what happens is the heart loves. The heart loves. And then we expand to karuna, which is the practice of compassion, where it is a permutation of loving kindness. But it goes beyond, may I be well, may you be well, to how can I help? It's a little more active. It might, sometimes it's said that compassion is what happens when love meets pain. Compassion arises. Or technically, it's often translated as the quivering of the heart in the presence of pain. It's karuna, compassion, and that's where it's said the heart responds. The heart responds. Mudita, appreciative joy. This is my favorite one, actually, and I think it's the hardest one. This way in which we rejoice for the joy of others. It's not about us. That we can find true happiness in other people's success without the voice that says, what about me? This is why it's so hard, because we so naturally compare ourselves to others, and somebody else may be experiencing just amazing joy, happiness, success, and we might really feel envious and jealous of that. And that's a place where the heart gets covered over. But this practice helps us actually participate with them in their joy, as a way to support our own. And that might feel counterintuitive, but when somebody calls you up and says, I am so excited to tell you about what just happened, and starts going through the list of all of their successes. My daughter just got this amazing job. My son was accepted to this incredible program, et cetera, et cetera. And you're thinking, my son, my daughter, I'm having such a hard time. And this is such a natural response for us. But in that moment where we notice the separation that we put in place by seeing, oh, that's them and I don't have that, that separates us. That's where the heart gets armored. Instead of saying, tell me more about that, and understanding that we have mirror neurons. So this is a little bit, I don't know a lot about the neurology, but I do know that we pick up on each other's energy. And when we let ourselves go to that place where we say, tell me more about what's happening with this. Or have you ever said to somebody, tell me something good. I need a little uplifting. Have you ever had that experience? Maybe you're down in the dumps and a friend shares with you something beautiful and wonderful, and you let yourself be part of that. It changes how we feel. We feel better. So this is mudita. It makes us so much more available to our lives. And in that moment when we can feel joy for somebody else, the weight of our own challenges lightens up, because it reminds us what else is possible, what else is true. It doesn't mean that our stuff isn't important and difficult, but in that moment, we actually can feel some joy, and that's important. We can change the word joy. Maybe it's contentment. Maybe it's aliveness. You can change it to whatever you want, a sense of being okay. That's mudita, and it's said that with mudita, the heart delights. And upekkha, equanimity, another primary aspect of these heart practices. This is tough, right? This is how we maintain balance in difficulty. This equanimity can be also thought of as perspective. Can we have a wide enough view that we can take in different ways of viewing the same situation? Or maybe we are in a particularly challenging time, but our equanimity is sufficient that we're not flattened by it. We actually say, this is hard, and I'm still okay. Have you ever had that experience? You know, you can go through something that's really hard, but you have a baseline, you have enough of a foundation to know this will change. This is hard. I actually have some skill and some resources. Doesn't mean it's not going to exhaust me, but we actually, through these practices, we get more capacity, more ability to bounce back, to ride the waves. A lot of metaphors for this. And this is where we get into this place of engage the next moment without an agenda. This is where the equanimity shows up. Can we be in the unknown? And there's so much that's unknown for all of us at any time in our lives. We actually really don't know a lot. So thinking of these four aspects of the Brahmaviharas of metta, loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity, the heart loves, the heart responds, the heart delights, and the heart allows. The heart allows. You know, there's this story that maybe many of you have heard that I like to come back to over and over again about how can we be with the unknown? And just because we think it's one way, maybe it's another. So there's this story of the old farmer who had a horse that ran away. And his neighbor came by and said, "Oh no, that's terrible." And the farmer says, "I don't know, you never know." The next day the horse came back and it was leading two other wild horses. And the neighbor said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And the farmer says, "You never know." Later, the farmer's son was training on one of the wild horses, and while riding the horse, he fell off and broke his leg. And the neighbor came by and said, "Oh my God, that's terrible." And the farmer says, "You never know." And then the Cossack army came through recruiting everybody, taking away all of the able young men. And they didn't take the farmer's son because he had a broken leg. And the neighbor came by and said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And the farmer said, "You never know." And it goes on and on and on like this, right? How we perceive a situation, it could have many permutations of it. And so our lives do depend on each other and everything else. They go from one thing to the next to the next. And what we need to do is be fully present, feel our hearts, and be willing to allow what is next. Louise Erdrich, the brilliant writer, novelist, she says, "Life will break you. Nobody can protect you from that. And living alone won't either. For solitude will also break you with its yearning. You have to love. You have to feel it. It's the reason you are here on earth. You are here to risk your heart. You are here to be swallowed up. And when it happens that you are broken or betrayed or left or hurt, or death brushes near, let yourself sit by an apple tree and listen to the apples falling all around you in heaps, wasting their sweetness. Tell yourself you tasted as many as you could. Let yourself sit by an apple tree and listen to the apples falling all around you in heaps, wasting their sweetness. Tell yourself you tasted as many as you could." That's what we're talking about, right? the joys and the sorrows, this path of love and generosity. We can't do this alone, and we come back to refuge in the Sangha. And the Dalai Lama again, through kindness, through affection, through honesty, through truth and justice toward all others, we ensure our own benefit. This is not a matter of complicated theorizing. It's a matter of common sense. So I want to move us forward a little bit onto this next thing I've been thinking about. How do we show up for each other? Right? How do we really show up for each other in this path of appreciative joy, this path of metta, of compassion, of equanimity, of companioning and consoling? And one of the places, you know, when we think about joy and sorrow, sometimes it's really easy to be with each other when things are good, when things are easy, when there's not a lot of sadness happening. For some of us, it's very easy to show up when there's difficulty, but not for everybody. And then there are the real challenges. What happens when there are big losses? How do we show up for each other in the biggest losses? And how do we work with what does that mean to be fully present and feel our heart and be helpful, be loving? So I wanted to bring in a little video today on working with grief and loss, with being present for each other. And Carlita is going to bring this up. It's just a few minutes. This is a video that comes from Megan Devine. And Megan Devine is the author of a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And she's a grief specialist, a psychoanalyst. And this comes from her website called Refuge in Grief. So we have refuge in love, refuge in all these things, where we find ourselves right where we are. So let's go for it, Carlita, please.
So what do we do about all the pain we see in the world? All the pain we feel in our own lives? And why does it seem like our best efforts to help somebody feel better always backfire? I've been studying intense grief and loss, baby death, violent crimes, accidents, suicides, and natural disasters. And I've learned something really interesting. Cheering people up, telling them to be strong and persevere, helping them move on, it doesn't actually work. It's kind of a puzzle. It seems counterintuitive, but the way to help someone feel better is to let them be in pain. This is true for those giant losses and the ordinary everyday ones. Educator Parker Palmer writes, "The human soul doesn't want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed exactly as it is." He's talking about acknowledgement here. Acknowledgement is this really amazing multi-tool. It makes things better even when they can't be made right. For example, somebody's struggling. Their baby died, or there's been a bad accident, or their mom got sick, and they're just sad. It's way more helpful to join them in their pain than it is to cheer them up. But here's what we tend to do instead. "You have two other children. You need to find joy in them." Or, "You know what you need? You just need to go out dancing and shake it off." Or, "I felt really sad once. Did you try acupuncture?" We're not really sure what to do with someone's pain, so we do what we've been taught. We look on the bright side. We try to make people feel better. We give them advice. It's not like this is nefarious. I mean, we try to cheer people up because we think that's our job. We're not supposed to let people stay sad. The problem is, you can't heal somebody's pain by trying to take it away from them. Now, acknowledgement does something different. When a giant hole opens up in someone's life, it's actually much more supportive to acknowledge that hole and let pain exist. It's actually a radical act to let things hurt. It goes against what we've been taught. In order to really support you, I have to acknowledge that things really are as bad as they feel to you. If I try to cheer you up, you end up defending yourself and your feelings. If I give you advice, you feel misunderstood instead of supported. And I don't get what I want either, because I wanted you to feel better. It's pretty rare that you could actually talk somebody out of their pain, Rarely does the admonishment to look on the bright side actually heal things for someone. It just makes them stop telling you about their pain. It's so tempting to try to make things better. When somebody shares something painful, it's much more helpful to say, "I'm sorry that's happening. Do you want to tell me about it?" To be able to say, "This hurts," without being talked out of it, that's what helps. Being heard helps. It seems too simple to be of use, but acknowledgement can be the best medicine we have. It makes things better, even when they can't be made right.
I love that. I wonder what you think of it. Let's take some time to talk about, what did you notice with that? What struck you?